Sure.
Snacks have arrived.
Did you guys sign in on the union check?
Still with us?
Did you sign in?
Yeah, get you more or less.
Yeah, more or less.
HR.
And you're still with us.
Yeah. What?
Did the logic.
Dave, I need you to sign in. Agenda?
Yeah, I printed everything out.
And the minutes were sent out to the committee.
Yep.
Back quite a while ago.
All right, I'm gonna call the meeting to order. She has an agenda review on here. Any changes we wanna make to that?
No.
Approval of minutes, October 27th. People read those? They've been out quite a while, I guess. Any changes to the minutes? Move for approval?
Move for approval?
There.
As written?
Say aye.
I'm aye.
Public comment. If anybody here wants to address the group. We're informal.
Oh, I'm David Doherty, landscape architect, just interested in the presentation and see how the progress has been.
Thank you.
David recently spoke out in favor of public plazas in downtown Eugene.
Absolutely right.
Thank you for that.
Yes. Yeah, strong supporter of public open space remaining public.
Yeah, for sure. Anybody else that want to introduce themselves?
I'll introduce myself. I'm Sandy Nelson, and I'm a new staff person of the city of Springfield, so this is my second week. And I'm the comprehensive planning manager, so I'm interested in what you all are working on.
Thank you. And?
Carolyn Miller, Springfield resident.
I'm Laura Buell. I'm with the state, and we're funding this project.
And I'm Joseph Reed. I support Marcia Herbstreit.
Moving on. Consultant's presentation.
Thanks, everybody, for spending here the next 2 hours with us this evening. I think it'll be good. I think well worth your time because we're getting into a lot of important details and there's a lot of substantial material here. We're going to talk about the two documents that you have. So one has pink is the development standards for the zoned property downtown. And the one with the cyan color blue has the is about the public works standards for the streets. We're going to go through mostly the development standards. This will be like 3/4 of my presentation, or maybe 2/3, and then the rest will be about the streetscape standards. But there's much more substantial material in the development standards now that we need to discuss. So I'll just jump right in and try to orient you to this document. And it was pointed out to me that I should make it clear to you that some of the material, the pictures that I'm showing here are not in the document. If there's something that I'm showing and I can give you a page reference, I'll do that. But some of the images were prepared just for this presentation to try to communicate some of the ideas. So I'll try to make it clear so you're not like thumbing through. I'm trying to find a picture on the screen. We have two different kind of overlaying types of regulations for the downtown district. One is sub-areas, and that has mostly to do with creating the building envelope. And the second set of regulations are all about streets and which street the building fronts and what it needs to meet, what kind of requirements it needs to meet in order to front that street appropriately. And these two things are not coincident. They're two separate systems, but they're very clear, very intricately linked. Any given site is going to be subject to a set of regulations that are part of the sub-area plan and a set of regulations that are part of the facade design or street frontage type. The three sub-areas that we have settled on at this point, since this is still evolving, are the first one is the Mill Plaza Island Park District, and it also includes this area south of South A. And the second is called Downtown Center, and it's the area approximately where we are now and a little further around us. And then everything else that's within the south of the Washburn District edge and north of the railroad is part of the downtown flex zone. Then this overlaying street system or street edge system has Main Street. That's this red pink line. South A, Pioneer Parkway West, and Pioneer Parkway East, the blue, and all other streets are the green. So if you're sitting on one of those types of lines, you're going to need to meet some regulations that come from that system. So first I want to talk about what the building envelope or the sub-area regulates and the reason we separated it out. The building envelope is something that, it's a kind of an architective term where it basically means that kind of jello mold that's created by the regulations that govern lot size, lot coverage, setbacks, building height, and setbacks. And here you'll see some of all of those at work. We have buildings built up, say, if this is the property line, zero lot line, we have a step back here, upper level, and we have a maximum height. And we also have showing, in this case, a side step back also. And the reason this is important to know about is because this is the maximum development shape that a developer could create, given your regulations. We don't have floor area ratio, we don't have these other things. So a developer could potentially take advantage of all of that volume to build in, but often they don't because there are things like parking that they'll want to provide sometimes on site that would prevent them from reaching that. Sometimes you can't provide all the parking that you would need to support that volume, and so the building becomes smaller as a result, or sometimes you have to accommodate that parking on site. Springfield's in a good position because they've decoupled the parking requirements from the site. This, not every development has to provide parking on site, and we're accepting that advance as part of our work because of the parking program that you're developing, and developers will pay into the program to fund parking off-site, shared parking. So that makes it more possible that a developer might be able to achieve the full capacity of the site. So each of the three sub-areas has a different approach to that building envelope, and I'm going to explain why. And if you look at the table on anybody gets there faster, we'll call it out. It's the table on page 211, and you should be able to kind of hold your document like this so you can look at the plan and the area together. These columns refer to the different three areas, D1, D2, and D3. And the things that we're regulating are on the left side in the left column. So in Mill Plaza Island Park District, we have some of the largest blocks that we have anywhere. And this includes the area south of A. There's a lot of development capacity there. And it was identified as an asset that could be used to achieve some of the public space around Mill Plaza. That the development that you could attract because of the size of the blocks that are somewhat unique in the region would be able to, through the tax increment financing program, help fund improvements to the Mill Plaza site. So it's part of a program kind of public and private investment and public improvement that are unique to some extent to the Mill Plaza and Island Parks District. So the proposal in these development standards is to keep that the way it is and not have any stepbacks. In fact, we're proposing to increase the height from the current 90-foot height to 120-foot height. There are some other principles that we want to talk about stepping building massing down to the park and providing through block connection to kind of continue the alley system and some things like that that would break down the block size a little bit. But it's still going to be one of the largest development sites, or these blocks will be the largest development sites in all of downtown. Then in the downtown center area, we're proposing that you have you keep the 90-foot total height limit, and you have at 45 feet, you have a 10-foot step back. And that also works at the side of the building if you have a 6,000 square foot lot. And so let me talk for a moment about minimum lot size, because that's one of the things that dictates how much you can develop to begin with. If you have a bigger lot, you can take advantage of the higher height. Right now, your standards are you've got to have a 6,000 square foot block in order to develop. That's the minimum block size. And that's a barrier for a lot of the smaller properties in the flex zone. And so we said, let's lower the block size for that sort of area that's outside of the center or the Mill Plaza area, and say 2,500 square foot could be your minimum lot size. That frees up a lot of land to develop without consolidation. Consolidation is when somebody comes in and they have to negotiate with their neighboring property or collect several properties before they can even begin to develop. So what this does in the third zone, the downtown flex zone, is that it permits some of these properties to maybe go ahead sooner. Now, as a result, you're probably going to see smaller building massing, because some of these buildings, for instance, take the little sliver there, which is about a 2,500 square foot lot, is pretty small, and you probably wouldn't build a 90-foot tall building on that site just because you couldn't lay out a good floor plate and maybe a number of other things. So we're likely to see maybe more dramatics, roof lines up and down, and variety in that area. But we might see development faster. And that's kind of the goal for that area. Are there any questions about this so far?
You're speaking generally of the south of Main Street, like Jim's Landing, that area through there.
Right.
I don't know whether those are individual owners, but I know those are very narrow businesses through there.
It might be good for me to, I don't know. Well, which page is that map on?
It's on 210, and it shows all the lots,
yeah.
So it's
D3. Yeah. So it is the area south of Main, like you're saying, those small blocks between South A and Main. There's also the area east of Pioneer Parkway.
Yeah, that's here.
We did a total analysis of all the sites in the downtown as to their size, and we saw that there were a lot of them that don't meet the 6,000 square foot minimum requirement, and that was partly why we drew the line for the downtown center where we did, because it seemed that many of those properties could be consolidated. But we didn't want to extend that too far, because we didn't want to extend the 6,000 square foot limit. Did that answer the question? Who asked that question?
Back to at D2 and the minimum square footage, 6,000 square feet. What happens if a developer comes in develop two lots and then someone has a third lot that meets it, and you end up with one little piece in the middle that's less than that? Or what happened? Could that happen?
You
end up with a parcel that nobody can really develop.
You could end up with an orphan parcel. Yeah.
And then what happens?
It could become part. Yeah, it's a good question. It's not something that we have resolved or answered at this point. We've talked about building into the code sort of in the third round of a draft, some of these tools that the staff can use to help someone develop even when they can't meet this minimum standards.
Yeah.
Things like for maybe based on the proposal portion of the development, they can get relief from some of the requirements. Or maybe there's an adjustment that's just off the top in certain instances. So we will work on that. That's a really good question.
It's important to have flexibility.
Laura, yeah.
Oh, something just popped into my head. Whether, I mean, obviously new parcels couldn't be created smaller than the minimum parcel size, but could it be permitted to develop, that any existing parcel could be developed, or is that just off the table?
If a parcel is below the minimum size, you mean?
Right.
It can't develop.
Right, I'm asking whether that's something that could be allowed. I mean, obviously creating new parcels or new lots would need to meet the minimum, but non-conforming lots could be.
Right, we have to figure out that non-conforming issue for for the 6,000 square foot limitation area. But, you know, interestingly, that applies right now to your downtown, just across the board. So what we were trying to do as sort of the first level of solving that issue was pull out the areas that seem to consist largely of small lots and say, okay, let's take those outside, let's remove that restriction.
So Marcy, maybe we're talking about two different things. Maybe we're talking about development area minimums or maximums, and we're talking about parcel size for partitioning. I don't know, it's just a thought. You know, we're kind of mixing those concepts.
I mean, development size being the total number of floors and within this volume that you could build?
Development area by the size of, maybe it's a 6,000 square foot minimum development area or a 2,500 square foot minimum development area. Maybe that would be a way to at least think about how to resolve that. Because parcel size typically is about division. It's about land division in a code, right? So anyway, I don't want to get hung up on
it. Yeah, we
just
talk about this some more. Right now, your minimum requires consolidation, not reduction, though. That's the typical direction a developer would have to go.
Yeah, at this point in time, I don't think you're going to be making smaller lots.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a question?
It's on a different topic. We're ready to move on.
Are we ready to move on?
Any other comments about lots?
No.
Okay.
I guess the second question is, if we have a person who owns a lot down on Main Street that happens to be 4,000 square feet or something, they want to make improvements. At what level of their improvements does it kick in that they're then required to meet these requirements? Could they just do little bits and little bits and never quite?
Well, that's a really good point. That's a non-conforming issue. And in a recent code that we just had adopted for a city in Washington, we developed quite an extensive program under the very obscure sounding title of proportional compliance. So it allowed non-conforming buildings to come into gradual compliance. We wrote specific rules that if you're within this threshold, size or defined by size or financial improvement level, you were subject only to this limited set of regulations. And if you were in the middle, you were subject to additional ones on top of that. And if you had this, if you fell into the above a certain threshold, you had to meet all the requirements. And the city, it's a little bit of a burden for this city, but they wanted to do this, so they keep track of this assessment. And they added at 5 years, if through gradual, you know, like repeated events of development, after 5 years this owner exceeds that threshold, they're automatically put into the next threshold for their next development application. So they can't just come back and do a little bit and a little bit and a little bit and avoid meeting the regulations altogether. So it was pretty well.
But it's not cut dry where it's either this or this. Flexibility.
Right.
Yes.
Based on the amount that they're improving. And bottom line philosophy was we want to encourage improvement. And we don't want to create non-conforming building form or non-conforming uses.
Okay.
What was your question?
Yeah, and I haven't been here before, so maybe you discussed this, but I'm curious as to whether you've discussed the purpose of the step back.
Yeah, let me talk about it here because I think it might be easier. We did these studies. At the last meeting we had discussion, we came in and proposed that you should have a step back on all the building massing in the entire downtown. And we got some pushback and people said, well, it costs a lot for developers to do that, and we do have streets that are wide, and maybe it's not necessary. One of the purposes that we stated when we came in with our original proposal was that it helps bring a little more light air into the street. And it also mimics this main street character and the height of the existing buildings. Here's a picture of the Emerald Building right now, and here's a picture of, so let me just go through this. This is what you have right now with the Royal Building. And then if somebody came in and built to the full 90-foot height on the adjacent lots without a step back, it would look like this on Main Street. Sheer walls on both sides. And then we drew it with a 45-foot height step back and a 10-foot step back. And we thought that this was more desirable for Main Street because, for one thing, it runs east-west, and that light and air is going to be important. We did similar modeling on the Pioneer Parkways, which run north-south, which are wider, and we decided that they don't really need that step back. It doesn't create the same, it doesn't even begin to have the same effect on those, just sort of meaningless. So it may be overburdening the developer to require that. Does that, is there more?
Nope.
There's, okay. Yeah.
Okay. So having you said that, the Mill District has the 120-foot limit. I mean, theoretically, maybe only these half that, but the allowable. And then, but across the street of South A, it's only 90. So it looks just like your examples there with the on Main Street, where you're casting a shadow from the Mill District across South A to the downtown center district, right? I mean, I guess what you're showing here, how is that any different than what you're trying to avoid on Main Street?
No, let me make sure I understand the question.
Well, the Mill Plaza has a 120-foot allowable height. Across South A in the downtown flex zone is 90 feet. So it's similar to the example that you were showing about on Main Street that you were...
The solar impact system.
Pardon me?
Well, on which
yeah, the impact of the light across, because the Mill District's on the south side of the street, and it kind of cast a shadow north, just like you were alluding to on your previous diagram.
I think explain that the plaza is on this side of the 100-foot, 20-foot tall building. So we thought that it would continue to have good southern exposure because of the depth of the plaza. It's almost a quarter block, half a block deep, in addition to those.
Yeah, but there's no setback required off of South A in the
Mill
District.
So are you talking about the block? If you look at the map, it's block number 24.
No, 35.
36.
Well, 35, 36, which is on the south side of the street from the downtown flex zone, correct?
Right.
So on the south side, you're allowing 120, but on the north side, you're allowing 90.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just saying, you on the well, this is south, and it's like this, a different allowable height, which casts a shadow north across the street. I don't know if that, and also on the south side, you're not requiring a setback to lessen that sun angle.
Yeah, thank you for explaining that, because now I understand what you're saying. That effect might be exacerbated with the likelihood that those larger blocks would develop more to the full height, and
yeah,
those infill
then the
blocks
ones on the other side
would not
really need
yeah.
the footprint
right.
or the a cumulative area, square foot.
Could you invert that? So you've got one on the north side, flip-flop the north and the south? So the ones on the south are gonna be shorter?
I think those blocks to the north are so small, and their lots are typically, well, actually, one of them is already both consolidated if these plat lines are correct, and I think that they are. The one just north of 36 is already one lot. I think maybe what we wanna do, rather than switch them, is look at a step back on the north side of the blocks immediately south of South A.
That's where I was leading, yeah.
Let's let Shannon get it.
So the Main Street has two lanes, the South A has three lanes, so first of all, you got the wider, so the lighting is not as much of a problem. I do agree with, after 45 feet, maybe bringing it in a bit. But the good thing too is because it's a railway area, having it taller for me is a sound barrier block too. So I'm fine, I feel it's comfortable having that being a taller area compared to the rest of the town, the downtown area.
So maybe taller overall, we keep that, but we have a step back just to, because it will allow more southern.
Otherwise, it's not very comfortable walking for the pedestrians in that area. As you know, anytime you're going into cities where there's high high buildings with no setbacks, typically people go on the other side because it's uncomfortable.
I was working on an appraisal on Olive Street. It was an office building, two stories, surrounded by capstone. And I could really feel that closed-in sensation. That was only four stories. I can't imagine nine with a two-story building around it. And I still think we need to have an area, as we do, that allows two-story minimums to attract their investment. And if you do that, then are they going to feel like they're in a hole if they're surrounded by really, really tall buildings?
Could be harder to get those lots developed.
Yeah. Yeah, it would discourage some of that.
Let me bring up another thing that this development, the development of this the Mill Plaza Island Park District, we are keeping that required minimum height. So this is a minimum height. Someone must come in and build a building that meets this height.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, we discussed this because it caused, I mean, some people questioned whether you wanted to do that because it might mean that some people can't develop right away. But that we've limited it to the area south of South A and within the Mill Park area. Yeah, because those are where the bigger blocks are, and we think those are going to attract the bigger developers coming in and building major employment office or major housing. It's very desirable land from a block size and urban access. How do people feel about that?
Well, maybe not make it so linear. Maybe there should be the ability for light to get through a couple of those lots with a lower building, because I can just see a really big wall that's cutting out the light to the two-story buildings.
Okay.
And the orientation is the south, the sunken to the south is going to be directly cut off of those buildings.
You already got the hills blocking it, so the sunken points will be different.
Does it make any sense at all to extend the streets north of A to give you the a little bit of a smaller grain there that you're mentioning, so that you have the extension of the grid to the south? Because there's still going to be big, huge massings of building there, but it starts to give it a structure and starts to give it some street frontage and an extension of the downtown.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that. If I understand what you're saying, you're talking about, like, say, between Block 35 and 34, clearly 4th Street down, or some semblance of 4th Street?
Well, not only 4th Street, but all the way along even to 39.
Right.
All those.
Right.
It just gives it a structure that is an extension of the downtown grid.
Right. We do want...
And it allows daylight through, it allows access, breaks it up, provides more retail opportunity on the street level, activating the streets.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of discussion going on around what should be required of those. We, at a minimum, our proposal was that there be a mid-block or a through-block, some sort of connection, if there's to be some flexibility about how the developer provided that, that it may not be a full dedicated street. It might just be a, not just, but it might be a privately owned but publicly accessible street. It could be for pedestrian and bikes only. It could be for cars if they wanted it to be. So there would be some built-in flexibility for the developer to determine what it was, but that it would connect with each of these streets that comes down and touches South A. And similarly, that there would be some sort of permeability in the blocks running toward Island Park, and that we preserve that alley network.
Yeah, I think that makes sense on what you're saying too, because then it puts the onus on the developer to make those improvements rather than the city, for one thing. But also, depending on what the projects are, they can they would possibly want to be linked laterally as well, you know, from one development to the next without going back onto the public street with vehicles, for example. So if the other side of the coin is what David was saying, it's all boils down to a specific project or projects and interconnectivity between whatever's on the board now and what might be on the board later, and to have the flexibility to connect the two without having a public street as part of the process. So it's all hypothetical, but.
It could also be used to access parking that might be around the back, or structured parking from the sides.
Right, and that's very desirable too, because then you don't have to have all those interruptions on the street.
Right.
So you'll probably see some version of that more fully developed in the next draft. The reason that we held off in showing more of it this time is because those property owners need to understand that this might become something that they need to be talked to.
Sure.
Okay, so moving
Marcy,
on.
Can I ask one question? So
yeah.
A 45-foot minimum or 3 stories required. So could a 2-story building,
mm-hmm.
would that be typical to have a 45-foot 2-story building?
Yes, you could do a grocery store with something on top. Not likely. I mean, if somebody's going to put something on top of a grocery store, they'd probably put multiple floors on. But yeah, you could have a 2-story building that still met that 45-foot height limit.
So why would we even say or 3 stories?
Because we like, because that's what Crandall and Rashford was for. you could say 45 feet, but we actually like instituting a story measurement in parallel, because we want people to give us generous stories. We don't like what happens when you provide a maximum height and everybody tries to crunch in these stingy floors into the height limits. If somebody, we've actually defined a story in the definition, so you can read how we define that. It's somewhat technical, but it allows somebody to come in and say, I want to build 12-foot residential floors, and I want to build your required 18-foot retail, but that's going to take me 10 feet above your maximum height. Is that going to be okay? And you would say, well, if it's this number of stories that meets these requirements, yes. Janet.
The reason why you need to have 45 feet or a 3-story minimum, in my opinion, is you don't necessarily want a big box store to take that spot and do the 45 feet, and then it just annihilates all of downtown's businesses as it is. So doing a 3-story discourages a big box store to just jump in and take all the parking, all the traffic, and that kind of direction.
Without also providing that other use, you're saying?
Exactly.
Okay. The office or the residential above?
Yeah, it just annihilates that area, making it a dead zone. And if they ever leave, that even makes it more of a dead zone.
Although there's some really great grocery stores that have been rehabilitated out there and are providing really vital activities in downtown these days. Any other comments about this before we move on?
Just one more. The podium, and I know there's definitions for these, but it doesn't, I think in the previous version there was a podium height and then there was the tower.
Yeah.
So for D1,
would you still even have podium?
We have the minimum building or podium height, as you've just mentioned, 45 feet of three stories for these two zones, and 25 feet minimum here. Would we still have a,
what was your question?
If you're, well, for subarea D1, is podium still a valid thing to even call out?
Because we don't have a step back?
Yeah.
I mean, we probably need to change the terminology, because, but they would be required to build a building. That's a minimum of, yet the building in this, and the podium in this case would be equivalent. We do have a little issue with that terminology. What's a tower? You know, because some of these, they're not really towers, they're not tall enough to be towers, but you sort of have to define them separately from the podium, and then
when you don't have a step back,
you don't have a podium. So we'll figure that out.
And Marcy, maybe just in your definition, if you had a sketch to go along with it for podium, that might help.
Okay. This is a podium, just for your, maybe this is a podium. Yeah. And this is the tower. Does that help?
And maybe just labeling on the diagram so that people can then make that correlation.
Okay, good. Very helpful. Right, so let's talk about the character that we're trying to create with each of these districts, because we're, in addition to that building envelope, we're trying to, through use mix and the way that the buildings are designed, trying to achieve different characters, sort of contrasting characters. So the idea is that Mill Plaza area is big, contemporary architecture, lots of bright light. Possibly you might even permit moving image signage. It might be getting into a little of the technical detail on the signage here, but it might be third-party signage, which means it's not even advertising the person who's in that building. It might be used by the city of Springfield or something. You know, so it's kind of putting it into a different category as maybe more of a regional place with some identity that goes beyond Springfield. And that would be done through the uses and the focus on the civic and cultural uses through the Mill Plaza. And maybe more entertainment venues are located here. But also, we want to make sure that it's still human scale by breaking down the big blocks with massing and pedestrian connections, at a minimum, pedestrian connections. The whole idea here is also that we're maximizing that urban development in order to pay for improvements to the plaza. And we'd like to make sure that building massing transitions to the river to maximize views. So there, we will probably come back in the next iteration with some idea of stepping back that massing at the river's side. So those are all characteristics of this area, as opposed to the downtown center, which is intended to be, to continue to be the focus of your downtown Main Street character retail, but even better than it is now, and still with entertainment uses would be permitted. All of these uses are permitted everywhere, and we're not proposing to change that. But the idea about the architecture is it would be more in the texture and break of the existing storefront architecture. Even if you consolidated a lot to the 6,000 square foot requirement, you would still be required to have a suggestion that it was the older module of architecture. And there's more emphasis on the Main Street building patterns, such as corner entries, storefront bulkhead, and building cornice. Even in a modern architectural idiom, some things would still be required. And that's spelled out in the facade requirements. And that's somewhat unique to this Main Street area and to the Main Street frontage overall. So is this starting to make a little sense? What do you think of that idea?
I'm still hung up on the requirement for the two stories that around the plaza, I think there needs to be some areas where you can put in a two-story building and get things rolling. I just can't envision people coming up and building these high-rises immediately around the plaza.
So you're required to only build 45 feet or three stories. That's what you're required to build. You
can't go further.
Right, you can build 90 feet if you want.
But the minimum size is going to be
45
feet.
I thought
it was 90 in that zone.
That's the maximum.
That's the maximum in downtown right now.
Okay, so the minimum in the Mill Plaza zone is 45.
So you could do a two-story, that's why I asked, could that be a two-story building?
That's better.
She said yes.
Yeah, but I would still like to see some areas we could put two-story in just to get things kicked off.
Yeah, 45 is, isn't that around the two-story?
Well, everywhere else you can build, you don't have to meet the minimum. Everywhere else you could come in, you could build a one-story building if you wanted to.
I'm sorry, you have to build a 25-foot tall, or it could be a one-story building. That's in the flex zone, that would be everywhere else, 25-foot minimum.
But there's nothing surrounding the plaza that would allow something that's two stories tall.
Yeah, technically three or 45 feet.
Right. Personally, I would like to see the allowance for something a little smaller in pockets around the plaza. That's just my thing.
Because you think that's too much to ask?
I think there's a lot of investment going in to kick this off and get the ball rolling. What I can envision is a few two-story brew pubs in that area, some nice restaurants. You're not gonna, if you can have a four-story building, three stories, you're gonna have what, apartments overhead and retail, restaurant down below, kind of like over by Costco, there's that development out there. I just don't see that. I see a two-story building with a brew pub and a restaurant.
Okay. Well, do you think it's reasonable to ask somebody to build two stories at 45 feet tall?
Not really.
The way I'm reading it, could you do false fronts?
That's a really good question. And we created mechanisms like this in other codes where you could meet the appearance of a minimum height, but not meet the minimum height. Then we created like a menu of things that through false fronts, through a tall entry, through a big shed that goes up toward the street side, a number of ways you could do it without having to build a multiple-story building. But in this case, in Roundville Plaza, we're trying to create that extra development value that feeds the tax increment financing mechanism. That's somewhat unique to the Mill Plaza area. So I don't know if just asking for the appearance to be met would get us to our goal.
Got it.
And we need capacity in the city. We need development capacity. So as you know, we're in the process of looking at our 20-year plan for commercial industrial employment use, and we need more sites. And the council wants more employment in the downtown
and more commerce.
And once
it's developed, I can see that, and I like that picture that I see. But getting it kicked off, I'm troubled by getting the ball. And I've seen other areas that have had great ideas. Nobody wants to go in there and start it. Who's going to be the first person to kick it off?
Well, you're all asking really good questions, and I appreciate that. We'll continue to develop this, but I think we should move on to the next topic, which is, going through the last zone, the downtown flex zone, which is that one that would allow, it's a bit more laissez-faire. If you've got a small site, you can still develop tomorrow. You can do retail on that street. The retail can be on the ground floor. As long as it meets certain standards for a horizontal distance and a vertical distance so that there's adequate transition between the sidewalk and the residential. Here's an example of a forecourt that's to a residential building that is actually a ramp going up. Here's an example of a resident, or it's actually a retail building, but it has set itself back from its property line in order to provide a planted area, additional kind of room and a different, more residential quality, more green. You could, in this area, also have this sort of live-work unit where the ground floor is a home occupation, say office, but it's part of the townhouse. So we're permitting that sort of thing to occur in that flex zone, which is the everywhere else zone, and hoping that that would, easing up on some of the restrictions like the minimum lot size, would encourage some of this kind of development that you're describing. That starts at, it's still somewhat proximate to the Mill Plaza. It's east of Pioneer Parkway East.
So, okay, now I want to move in and talk about this, the building, this overlapping system of regulations that governs the building frontage and facade by street type. This is a really important zone. Once you have the building envelope set up, we think that this is the next most important zone to regulate of the buildings, kind of the first 35 or 45 feet, or the height of that podium or whatever we decide we're going to call it. And it's defined by its relationship to the street mostly, the degree of transparency, the amount of building indentations in the form of courtyards, and the amount of the kinds of encroachments out, such as bays, bay windows, or balconies, surface detailing and articulation, and the ground floor height and the accommodation of retail for the future. And the sign size, location, and illumination also give a lot of character to this. So these three street types that we went through earlier, each of those has different requirements for that. And along Main Street, it's much more about creating that, recreating and improving that Main Street experience. And in the Mill Plaza area, it's a little bit more about light and entertainment and bigger development. So there's a kind of cheat sheet here on page 2.18 that goes through the street edge type and how they differ from each other. And I think I've talked about a lot of this already, so I'm not going to spend time going through it. Maybe just to talk about the signage one more time, that on the Main Street, the signage would not be permitted to be the signage type that we're talking about in the Mill Plaza area. Not third party, that means, and not moving image or illuminated. So much more low-key, traditional storefront type of signage, limited to blade signs and under awning signs. Intended specifically to market to the pedestrian on the sidewalk and not the cars driving by. So that might be different than what we expect from the Pioneer Parkways, where we allow bigger, brighter signage. Any questions about that or thoughts?
I'm interested in what the committee thinks about that idea, because I haven't heard the committee talk about signage that way before, so.
As a business owner, that kind of scares me, because I want the people that are driving by to and stopping at red lights to be able to see the business. And when you're talking about pedestrian awnings or pedestrian signs and window signs, in a cloudy city like ours, the font size that you're talking about, it's really hard for me to imagine a car could be able to see it. But at the same time, I understand the ugliness that can easily be done by overzealous signs. So I'm open to suggestions on the idea, but it's still, as a business owner, I always go, I want to show off.
Well, would you please, Shannon, as a business owner, I hope you have a chance to review the section that starts on page 2.20.33. I'm having a hard time. Yeah. But it's the signage section. And it goes into some detail about different types of signage as we and the city currently define them, where they're located, how they would be placed and measured, and then some picture examples as well. And it ends with a table that shows which streets you would be permitted to do which signs on. And one of the things that Linda pointed out to me earlier, which may be somewhat controversial, it might be exactly to your point, is at the bottom of this table on 2.40, at the bottom row you see illumination. We're saying that internal illumination is only permitted on South A Pioneer Parkway East and West, but it's not permitted on Main Street. Illuminated signs. So this may be one of the points that you are troubled by.
The only thing I can imagine is based off of the width of the street, I can understand that idea, because on A Street, when people are driving, South A Street, when people are driving by, an illuminated sign they can see pretty easy. While on a two-lane kind of street of Main Street, an illuminated sign probably does not mean much because you're more looking up, which is not something you typically do as a driver. The only thing I could think of, you know, I would have to really look at my signs again and collect pictures of signs, so I like to look at it. But if it was down below the awning, a lighted sign, I don't know. Or, you know, if it's below, you know, a 25 feet mark kind of thing for a nice clean look. I guess if it's too big, it starts getting obnoxious. But like on 239, you got Seattle Fish Company, an appropriate sign, in my opinion, for something that would be on Main Street.
I look at the new signs that have gone in recently. I mean, there's the locksmith people, and there's the flower market. I mean, most of those are illuminated signs, so I'm just warning you that people are going to have some serious concerns about prohibiting.
Excuse me, but it does say internally illuminated.
Right.
So you can still have some soft uplighting, downlighting. They can still be illuminated from what it says, but just not a neon sign is what you're trying to.
The plus side is it makes it easier for businesses to come in, because for example, my sign cost me $8,000. That's hard for a business to do. If a business is jumping into downtown, anything. You know, window signs and the pedestrian signs, and that's all you have to do to jump in. Hey, more success for them.
But they're jumping in. They want those signs. Yeah. That's what they're putting out there because they're trying to attract people that are in cars, essentially. So I'm
I see both ways.
Giving an opinion about it. I'm just saying
that one,
that that's
just
going
to
be
the data
a big
to
deal
see.
For some people.
Okay.
So just to be aware of that. And then the other thing is when we talk about. Because we did have our sign code staff person review this for legal issues, and we cannot regulate content of signs. We can only regulate size and shapes and that sort of thing. So when you talk about third-party signs being allowed in one district or another, third-party signs are allowed anywhere. We cannot regulate that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that's it's an Oregon law. So you're saying that you could allow Tourism Oregon, say, or some, you know, somebody to come and rent Shannon's sign and advertise something that has nothing to do with Shannon's store?
Yes.
Okay.
Or Shannon could make some money by renting his sign. Yeah.
The first party, second party, third party, is that something that's in your code now?
No, that's state law.
Oh, that's state.
No, what Linda's saying is that that's something that we have developed for other cities, but Linda's reminding me that in Oregon that is not permitted because you can't regulate, it's a free speech issue, and you can't regulate the content of signs anywhere in Oregon. So the second, third party sign definitions we have here would not apply.
Oregon has a stricter free speech protection than the U.S. Constitution. So Oregon allows even more free speech, which limits what you can regulate on some of this.
What if we just don't allow flashing or blinking?
Well, so we do define movable image and using some of the latest technological understanding about signs, we've defined what those are, and we've gone ahead and said some of those would not be permitted on certain streets. But we did say some, those might be the ones that are permitted on Highland Parkways, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a general direction that we're going, and we'd like your comments on that. Now you look troubled, Shannon.
Oh, no, I was just thinking about the whole thing.
Okay.
I agree with the whole, I mean, I love the Las Vegas look, but when you're talking about residential being on the second story or third story, the last thing they need is to be continually reminded that there's commercial business down the road.
And then anything?
Did you have a question?
Well,
I was just going to go back and reiterate what David has said, that internally versus externally. I think that's where you can really make a distinction in terms of the character of the signage. So I see, particularly in the
zone, we can have more residential, that would be externally illuminated, or if you want to have more internally illuminated in Main Street.
Okay, good. Did you have something again? Okay, so moving on. So one of this is about the building frontage types, and we talked about this a little bit, but let me just go quickly through. On Main Street, we are requiring that there be a minimum ground floor height. That's pretty dramatically different than what your Main Street now. But we think that you should have the highest quality retail space in your new buildings anywhere in Springfield on Main Street, and that should be a higher standard than anywhere else. So it's a 18-foot tall interior floor height. It's defined in the code how that would be measured. And that we're also requiring that it be fire-resistant construction on the ground floor so that you can accommodate retail in the future, even if retail is not viable at that time. That's a different standard on other street types, so the all other streets would not be held to that high standard, but it would still be a 14-foot or a fire and a fire-resistant construction for a building that's going to accommodate retail. You could also have a residential or oriented frontage type where there's, if you can see this drawing, it's a little bit hard to read. This is the back of the sidewalk. This is what would be the back of the sidewalk in a typical retail zone. Instead of having a sheer wall of a retail building, we would require a set back and planted area, and also possibly a vertical rise that could be accommodated through a ramp or stairs and a ramp. But it provides that kind of privacy that ground floor residential needs. A lot of people were talking earlier today about the Capstone project in Eugene, which I guess is an example of. Doesn't provide much privacy and doesn't provide much of a gracious sidewalk. So these are the three frontage types, and this is the only one that's permitted on Main Street. These two are permitted in the other areas, in addition to a series of landscape perimeter treatments. And the assumption there is that in these other areas, we may not have a building that is able to run the full length of the width of the lot. There might be parking on the side, surface parking, or there might be another use that the building might be set back further, might be a pre-existing building, but we still want that edge to be defined with a planting, if not a building. So you have to meet one of those frontage types along the full length of your property where it faces the street.
Okay. I have a question upon 2.19, the building frontage figure 2 map. So the street edges, I'm assuming that they affect both sides of the street, even though there's a white space shown.
So this, you're talking about this plan?
Yeah.
Sorry, what was your question?
Well, so for example, street edge B, you know, you're showing it all along South A, and I'm assuming that means both sides of the street?
Right. That little white gap is just a graphic.
And I think, you know, people might have more questions about why all the way to 10th, for example, on the retail, that's really super heavy duty retail frontage. Why not on South A, where we might have more development potential from a vacant site, where we might actually get that kind of condition? I don't know. So just more explanation or rationale for why you think those are the best locations for those particular frontage types would be helpful.
Okay. So these are photographic examples of the frontage types. This would be a typical retail one, retail frontage one, urban retail one, that's what we call it. And this is a good example of the residential frontage type with this terrace setback, and we've talked about these two already. All right, so let's talk about the Washington Historic District edge, because this is really important. What we have existing is a 90-foot height
right along the edge of the historic district. So we have these little houses that are going to remain with a lot of yard space around them. And then we have a development pattern that not being taken advantage of today, but could in the future with zero lot line. Buildings can go all the way up to the edge of the property and they can go 90 foot tall. And that's a pretty harsh juxtaposition. So we studied the edges that were created by this meandering line. There are basically three edges, three types. There's the street-facing edge where you have that sheer 90-foot wall across a street from a historic structure. There's the where you have that condition across an alley. And then there's the one that's sort of most severe where you've got it right sitting right next to it on the side lot line. And we developed a series of step backs and setbacks that we think address it or begin to address that issue. So if you look at these drawings, this is what's there now. Say that this is on the across a street from the Washburn District, but somebody could tomorrow come and build a 90-foot tall building here. So if they did that under these proposed regulations, they would be required to step it back at that 45 feet. If they were on the side lot line, though, they would be required to set it back. You can kind of see that. And step it back at about the height of the house in addition to what they would have to do on the street side.
My suspicion is if those in the Washburn District would be very uncomfortable with that height.
Right. I think that we
even
we know we're here for that discussion. And this might just be a starting point.
Yeah.
And we have to work on additional sculpting and modeling. The tension that comes from the other side, though, is that we, by doing even just this much, which is probably not enough, you make some of the smaller lots impossible to develop on. Someone might not be able to take advantage of the 90-foot height. They might only be able to go up to this first terrace just because the lot is so small. We do have some 2,500 square foot lots there. In much of the area, though, abutting this, we require the 6,000 square foot lot consolidation to begin with. So those sites are going to be bigger automatically, I think. So we got some advice that we need to talk with Washburn representatives early and often about this, starting now.
John is our Washburn rep and our historic rep here.
I'm probably more co-development as a designer than I am as a preservationist. I think you'd get quite a range of feedback, and I'll let everyone know that there'll be a presentation coming up. They can voice that. You know, it's interesting along the edge of the Washburn. It's really kind of a gray area. For instance, on B Street, many of the one-time residences are actually insurance agents, and there's actually very few of those houses that people live in. So there's already kind of a little bit of a buffer between that and getting further into the neighborhood. But visually, it would be nice if it was a little more harmonious and that we really kind of paid attention to how those buildings responded. So it is a conversation that I think needs to take place.
Sure. Yeah, my only concern is downtown Springfield is so tiny as it is compared to many other cities of a population 80,000 or more. And the restricting its volume can be kind of concerning in its future, I feel. And I agree that Washburn needs its preservation, but at the same time, there's already so many commercial plazas in the city between Gateway, between Mohawk area, Paramount area, and downtown Springfield. Downtown Springfield cannot lose its square feet and be less than its full potential.
I think that the attorney is also looking at the issue of
if we do reduce it, we create even more of a transition, a harmonious transition, which I think come from additional setbacks and stepbacks. It does take development capacity away from people.
Yeah.
And while people aren't complaining about that now, in other cities where we've worked, that becomes a huge issue. We'll have someone sue the city because of the new regulation that maybe made it impossible for them to develop that site right there under the new, because we cut into it with all of our setbacks and stepbacks.
So it's a, I guess the two areas of real concern are D1 and D2. In the flex zone, it's probably likely based on the site, out of the lot sizes and available areas to infill, that it may not ever be an issue, but maybe D2 where we back up to it.
We're talking about like right here?
Yeah, that could, yeah.
Or here.
Yeah,
actually,
right
here.
In those
yeah.
areas that I think would require some sensitivity. But again, you know, you don't really get into residential till you get into the north-south streets or up to C Street.
And again, to just on top of your point, this, the side lot lines are the most, I think, the most difficult ones. That's where a building's going to be sitting right next to on the lot. The street and the alley space help make a little bit of a,
mm-hmm.
help that grade more harmonious transition. Anyway, so this is an issue, and please, if you can bring people to the open house next week, so we can talk about it with them. So now I want to talk quickly about the streets, because we have like 20 minutes left. So this is the other document. If you could pull that one out. We're going to talk about, I'm going to give you more of an overview of this. We have four street types that we have written sort of standards for. They represent actual streets, but they're also trying to be generic. And we haven't hit that exact right spot yet between the generic and the specific. But there's a lot of good information here that I just want to point your attention to, mostly having to do with the sidewalk zone and the sidewalk expansion zone. So I'm going to quickly go through the four types, just explain what they are, then we'll focus on sidewalk and sidewalk zone expansion. We've selected this one type of street, north-south livability street, because it's a collector, typically an example location would be Fifth Street. Fifth Street is by itself a really important street because it connects the neighborhood to the downtown. And the generic section is a sidewalk zone, parking on both sides, and a two-way travel. But we did get pushback today that there needs to be looking at Fifth. If we're looking at Fifth, or we're going to call anything north-south livability street, we should be looking at least one option that shows it as a bike priority rather than an on-street parking priority. So family-friendly, protected cycle track, way to get to downtown.
This street's difficult because it's already narrow, at least up to East Street, and there's not much room, and the cyclists go over to 4th Street.
And we are talking about, I mean, we are, while a lot of people were thinking about 5th Street, I think, as the street that goes all the way up,
mm-hmm.
our study area is limited to, and short of D Street, to that narrow section. So we probably could look at some options that look at acquiring right-of-way in new development that maybe gets us everything that we might want on 5th Street within that zone, and then they have to figure it out what happens.
So what's the problem with Pioneer Parkway being used as the bike lane, since it already goes from Q Street all the way to pretty close to the main street?
For the growing older or family-oriented bike population, they're not comfortable riding on those types of streets with, say, their kids in tow.
There's a dedicated bike lane.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Pioneer Parkway.
In the middle area.
There's no feeling of safety.
This Main Street is a street by itself. This is a generic type, but it only applies to Main Street. We probably aren't going to see any other things like this. So the priority here really is retail and on-street parking. And bicycles are certainly invited in. We want to try to slow that traffic down and use signalization and pull downs at the intersections and lots of things to change the way that traffic uses that street now so that cyclists can feel more comfortable sharing, but this is not one of those streets where we're going to be arguing, I think, about cycle track or something instead of on-street. However, there was some discussion about should we permit curb extensions mid-block to shorten the distance for crossing, and there was a lot of discussion about that, so we want to know your opinion on that in a moment. This is a difficult street, South A, because it's currently undergoing a study of its own as part of the larger regional LTD project. And then this street is very interesting. This is the one that we talked early on, choosing a street that wasn't found in the functional classification list, meaning it's a local street, and there might be some freedom to do different things on that street, make it a festival street, maybe get rid of the curbs, build in more planting, have different configurations. And this type applies to both a street like A, but also just a thinner local, skinnier local street. But it also has to apply to Mill, because Mill is the east-western edge of the Mill Plaza. And that's going to be interesting discussion, because that's currently a functional classification of major collector. And so the city is watching that, and it's we're not sure why it's a major collector really, but.
And we might have to amend the TSP for that.
Okay, so we've set some minimum standards for the sidewalk zone. And then we discussed today that maybe these aren't adequate, maybe not for Main Street, maybe not adequate on other streets as well. But I'll just tell you what they are. So we have taken best practices from other cities and cataloged out the different zones of the sidewalk. And I think I talked to you about this before. But there's the frontage and marketing zone, which is the zone right next to the building. This is the building. In this case, this is a residential building with a little entry court. And these are two parallel plans and sections where this is the retail version and this is the residential version. So the frontage and market zone is usually 2 feet in a decent 12-foot wide total sidewalk zone. The pedestrian through zone, it has to feel comfortable. It's ideally, two people walk abreast and they can actually pass two other people walking abreast, which you can't really do in just 6 feet. But that's what we've said at this time is the recommended dimension for a total of 12 feet. Then there's the street furniture zone, where the street trees and the furniture go. In a downtown retail street, it's usually a street tree and a tree well with a grate, so it's kind of a continuation of the sidewalk. But in a residential zone, that area can sometimes be a continuous plant strip, or it can be an intermittent, longer plant strip, but it's usually not a grate. Then the edge zone is usually the curb. And then this other zone that is kind of claimed out of the parking zone called the sidewalk extension can actually extend that sidewalk zone, and so it looks a little bit like this. You've seen these mid-block crossings. When this is at a corner, turns the corner, this is called a bulb out. And the whole point here is that it can reduce the crossing distance and encourage mid-block crossing. There was a lot of discussion about whether this should be permitted on Main Street right now, which we're saying it should be, but I think there's some people that think it shouldn't be.
What are the negatives to that? Why are people objecting to that?
There's just a school of thought amongst transportation engineers that you shouldn't be encouraging people to cross willy-nilly. It's dangerous. They could get hit by a car going too fast that doesn't stop.
Because it does seem as though if you come up to the corner, if you have a bulb out like that, it does give you greater visibility to see people and traffic on either side. It's just your visibility is increased so much more.
Well, they didn't have a problem with the corner bulb outs. It was the mid-block.
Oh, okay.
And that would be about parking.
Yeah, I agree with the bulb outs. Bicycle traffic. You get up to an intersection. If they had space to come up and stop, in other words, because it just didn't go up quite so. I'm not saying we shouldn't do this, I'm just thinking about bicycles, how we get bicycles in there without being in this traffic, this lane, at an intersection.
Well, isn't that a shared, sharrows, a bike lane with the car lane, so you don't have a separate?
Well, that's true, but.
Now, when you do, it would need to be held back, of course.
Yeah, this is an example of the street functioning as a shared with the cars, so they don't need to share with anyone.
It's always when you come up to a traffic signal, and they stop, and you stop, you don't know who's gonna do what. It's complicated.
So there.
Often they don't stop.
There's just a larger point I wanna make about the sidewalk extension, so we've studied part of our material guidance standards that are in the streetscape, requirements for the bike corral parking or parklets that would occupy this zone, requirements for what this would be if it occupied this zone, and then we're using the street types to say where those would be permitted or prohibited, and how they would have to be located. And I think we're still working that out.
What happens if an owner of an establishment wants to extend the sidewalk, and they do something that's, you know, a poured concrete piece, and then it changes hands, and then someone says, well, we don't want it, or use it, and you tear it out or something, I don't know.
You always bring up the really tough questions. Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, I like something that's less permanent on the right. Well, it's great. You can mark it in some way with a change of, you know, paving texture and a planting or something, but it could go away as well.
There will be requirements that they be removed and temporary and all that in the program. We have to develop a program to allow parklets. So we've done some work internally on that, but haven't completed it.
When on Main Street,
right?
If you did bulbouts, would you do it on every intersection, or would you do it every other intersection, or have we kind of taken it to that point?
If it was up to me, if I were free to recommend.
Okay,
it,
yeah.
I would say every single intersection. And I would say at certain mid-block crossings as well, where the desire line seemed to call for that, because there was a transit stop or there was a pathway that people used frequently. And on Main Street, the goal, I think, is to get that to function as a street where people feel comfortable jaywalking, comfortable crossing anywhere, not necessarily at a channelized location.
Currently, 4th Street, we've attracted a lot of people there, but it's a terrible intersection. Mm-hmm. There are no pedestrian markings.
I'm working
on doing a bulb out on each intersection and not other places would be a great improvement.
I've been working on trying to get that intersection marked with good, bright colors on the crosswalks.
Steve and I have threatened to, you know, you're
do our own
paint
yeah.
thing and draw things on it, so you might have to bail us out.
The evolution is if you had bulb outs out, you'd decrease parking probably about 15% on the Main Street, which would encourage the people to say that we need to have a parking garage. I think it'd be a win-win.
And those actually are bulb outs right now, they're just old bulb outs. So we have bulb outs.
And there is a
the old ones.
There's a misperception that they do displace parking, but they really don't, because you can't parallel park that close to an intersection anyway.
Right.
So the bulb out occupies the non-parkable dimension there.
That's a good point.
But people think, less parking. Okay, you know, you're missing out on two more parking spaces at every corner.
That's true.
So we took a look at street furniture, and we had always been doing this, but we've gone down the path that I think identifying some specific brands. The city wanted us to look at suites of furniture and identify a selection of principles so that they can work with developers who come in, and as part of their development, they have to provide furniture. They would have clear guidance about what to provide and exactly where it should be located. So these are the two suites that we've selected that go with. They were They were selected to go with the lights that you currently have. And the principles are pretty simple. Streamlined traditional style, material palette of slatted steel compatible with your existing streetlight design, color complements with black or other dark colors. And these are specific manufacturers, but we've removed all names. And then we've just prepared for this point in time graphics to these would eventually go into a package, I believe, that's the intention, that would be handed to a development applicant, along with all of the specifications that are elsewhere in the document about placement. But the city wants to make clear that they reserve the right, they need to have the right to really approve these on a case-by-case basis, even though we're writing standards that will make the requirements more clear. And that's kind of the end of the presentation.
Quick question about furnishing. For your furnishing zone that you showed on a previous slide up against the curb, is there flexibility there? Because I know a lot of times, you know, we have big blank walls along your facade. There's nothing better than to have your bench with the back up against the wall looking out to the street scene. Whereas sometimes it's pretty uncomfortable to have a bench right along the curb with traffic behind you. So I was wondering if there's some built-in flexibility that would allow benches along the building facades.
Only if we make this wider, which we're discussing, that might be made wider. But that might be, the way we're thinking it would be made wider is that the property owner dedicates that, maybe doesn't formally dedicate it to the public right-of-way, but and, or the city doesn't acquire it formally, but they set their building back. That would create a better frontage zone that would accommodate benches and things. So the 12-foot sidewalk, there's discussion that the 12-foot sidewalk might not be adequate.
Yeah, it's very minimal, but you know, where you do have a bench along the building, you simply wouldn't put other furnishings directly in front of it within the furnishing zone. You wouldn't put a tree there, you wouldn't put something else, so that you would still have the same dimensions for walkability.
Yes,
but you just have to serpentine a little bit.
I'm just not sure that zone at 2 feet, which is what it is in a 12-foot sidewalk, is sufficient for a bench. And I think you're maybe talking about meandering
right.
the through
yeah,
zone.
Simply walking yeah. around it.
Right.
Yeah, and you wouldn't put a bench where there's a where your window shop. It would be more selective. I'm just wondering if there's a built-in flexibility that would allow that.
Blocks that toggle it, where B becomes C and C becomes B. Is it kind of your idea?
Well, you know, this could be the general condition, but there would be exceptions based on the specific building, adjacent buildings or conditions that are there.
He's talking about switching A and C. I think you could, it may be worth looking at that on that special street, the Festival Street. On Main Street, you're thinking of it on
Main. Well, yeah, where there's big blank walls, mm-hmm. obviously, you wouldn't do it in front of a window.
So the standard really is to allow the clear width for the pedestrian and to accommodate all these other uses, and so that was the scope of work, was how can we do that? But the scope of work didn't pay for a plan, you know, a plan
right.
view where you could show those relationships.
Right, and so maybe that's something that will come later, but because you know, it's uncomfortable to have a backless bench. You know, if I'm
right.
up against the street with cars going by, or even parked, you can't do it with just parked cars either. You need to open up your car door. So a lot of times that doesn't work, especially on the narrow sidewalk. You know, for benches. Yeah, unless you put them perpendicular, but then you don't have enough distance to do that.
So, well, that's just one advantage of this sort of thing. An engineer today pointed out that these are not just for crossing. They can be used for planting and furniture. You could put a couple of benches with planting behind them on both sides
yeah.
of the
We do
crossing.
A lot of streetscape designs, and a lot of times that's the only place there are for
benches
and other furnishings, bicycle racks, things like that.
Any last minute comments?
I see two different kinds of benches, one with arms and one without.
Right.
With my experience in San Francisco, that they went from an armless bench, which allows people to sleep, therefore eliminating the occasional mother and children who have to come along and find a place to sit, and having the arms just like that sort of uncomfortable thing where you can't find a place to sleep in an airport because they have the arms there. It does allow pedestrians a place to sleep, which might occasionally be occupied by sleepers.
So I'm asking,
is there a particular design that's been picked out for the entire city, and it would be one design, or is that location specific?
Neither. We're trying to just show if you choose furniture that meets the principles, it might look like this.
Okay.
And we haven't, or I think maybe we have addressed the issue of things like skateboarding and armrest and resting, and it's probably somewhere in our specifications.
Okay.
That's what you're talking about, really, right? You're talking about having furniture that doesn't permit somebody to lie down and
dominate the furniture. And while I have no inherent objection to that, it's just that it keeps people who actually need to sit and rest, it eliminates that possibility.
Right. More shareable furniture.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So usually you have an armrest right in the middle of the bench.
Yeah.
As well as on the edges. Because
yeah.
The
right.
edges alone won't prevent that.
No, that's exactly right. In a normal bench size, there would be two armrests, and that would allow three people to sit there, as opposed to if you don't have the minimum there, and then that allows somebody to sleep, which I don't object to, unless there's a mother with four children who really needs to rest because she's wearing high heels.
Okay. thanks for all your time. I know this is very, very technical stuff, and I appreciate your good questions, difficult questions.
This is good stuff. Pretty complicated, but good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Very nice presentation. Thank you.
Linda's going to be talking to us, but I want to say this. I'm going to say this before she does. We need more people, but what we have here is absolute quality people. The input here is extraordinary. Yeah. Don't quit coming. Stay here, you guys. It's real important.
It's a great discussion. Do you guys feel that this is moving in the right direction? Is there anything that just hits you in the gut as being off? You've been in this for so long. Some of you are the core people that have been with this project from the very beginning.
That's why if we bring in new people, might have to bring them up to speed a little bit, but this is the core people.
Well, you know, my only complaint, I'm not sure it is, but we seem to go such distance between these meetings that, you know, I kind of forget, you know, what my involvement is.
That's where people are dropping out.
And I think it's going in a great direction. I'm happy with what's going on here. But, I don't know.
Well, I see having been involved with the design committee that is no longer. I'm happy to see that there's going to be some codification of the facade improvements, or the facade part of all of this, along the, you know, technical, but that's what it takes, you know, and that's what constitutes a code, so that's the way it has to be, other than the way we were doing it before, more subjective perhaps, but I'm glad that all this is going to merge someday into a document.
I think it's starting to have some nice clarity to it as well, but it's pretty good. You can look at a particular zone and, you know, and see what the requirements are and your street edge and it's going to make a lot of sense to those who have to follow it.
Designers and architects.
Well, I'm always asking myself,
are we really accomplishing things, or as more of yes men kind of do. And because you've got the experts that are doing the stuff, and they give an argument which could be biased, could not be biased, but sometimes because of our limited experience, we don't know. So we're always like nodding our heads agreeing kind of things, because they're usually the ones that know the more appropriate things. But then there's times that I remember we had been so serious several years ago talking about the parking issue in downtown, and I still have not seen that process move forward. So I sometimes wonder, are we yes men or
are we action? We need more action.
Well, I'm just, when I'm a business owner and I go, hey, we need more of this, I simply call them and ta-da, it's like magic, I got it all taken care of. Here, I have to be patient.
Okay, Linda?
I didn't have anything, just to say that this will be going to the Planning Commission on May 3rd, and then we have a community open house on May 4th, which is a week from yesterday, and I'm hoping that some of you can come and kind of help talk to the general public that will be really new to this. That would be fantastic, and to invite others to show up and see what we're doing here so it's not a big surprise. We have sent out a notification. We sent a postcard to anybody that was within the downtown refinement plan area and a 300-foot buffer around it. And then we're going to be doing some email. I think an email went out today as well to a larger email list. So we are...
Anybody have anything to say?
Forward.
Any thoughts?
Lots of good things.
Okay.
And then the council will have a work session later in May.
We are adjourned.
And then, I guess, and then our response, other subcommittee's response, the Planning Commission, they'll kind of put that together.
For the next draft.
For the next draft.
Yes. So we're only about halfway through this. So there's a lot more work to do.
Don't quit. We have
a scope of work, and again, the TGM program with the state is paying for this, so that's why we're not able to have monthly meetings or more frequent meetings with our consultant team. And I don't know if it would add value to have meetings without them, to have more discussion. So that's why we haven't done any interim.
Things simple.
I guess that's where it was more felt like a wasted meetings. When we'd have the meetings and we'd have lots of, well, we didn't have lots of them, we had four a year, wow. Mm-hmm. But, and in between the times you'd have this, the experts talking, that middle time was almost like it waited for us to talk, but nothing really can be accomplished in that because you don't have the experts bouncing the ideas off of.
Right.
So doing it with the experts is definitely appropriate. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we're not getting anywhere.
But you know, all those conversations we had really are hearing through right now. You may not realize it, but like the three different sub-areas that came straight out of some work that this committee did, talking about one-size-fits-all standards aren't going to work for us. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And we even mapped it, and so that's where a lot of this has come from. So we're trying to pull all those threads back together and go forward.
Ready? Adjourned again?
Yeah.
Thank you.